Recorded live from the Phantasmo Lounge, located high atop the Ron Jeremy building in beautiful downtown Chesapeake, it's Phantasmo After Dark, with your host, Rob Floyd, and Professor Tony Mercer. Tonight's topic, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
Ron Jeremy, very big in Chesapeake, from what I've... very big anywhere.
Very big everywhere, from what I understand. Oh, yes, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. We spoke of this before, I believe.
I'm still reeling from Ron Jeremy.
Well, from what I hear, most people do. But that's not tonight's topic.
No.
Though it could fill a whole hour. And many other things, too, from what I'm led to believe. But back to the show.
Yes, a very familiar topic indeed.
We've had discussions about this film quite a few times.
Recently.
Recently, even. Some of them recorded. And not very well, so that's why we're back again doing this. But seriously, folks, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. Probably, maybe a guilty pleasure for some in Universal, but definitely one of my favorites for a lot of different reasons. Would you like to know them?
I would, in fact.
Okay. One, it was the first Universal monster film that I had ever seen when I was about 7 years old, 7, 8 years old. Stayed up late, watched a new show that came on called Saturday Night Live, and then right after that was Dr. Madblood. And that's when they had the Universal package could be shown on TV. And, you know, what a great way to be broken in. You got two monsters battling it out at the end of the movie. And
what a great way to be broken in by Ron Jeremy! Sorry, help myself.
That's called a running gag, folks.
Callback.
Anyway, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, great, great fun film. A lot going on in it. And I believe it is the first film that was a direct sequel to two separate films. I mean, you don't really see that a lot. Usually a sequel is a succession of from one film to the other, not counting the Avengers recently. And that was kind of unusual.
Yeah, being the sequel to both The Wolfman and simultaneously the next installment in the Frankenstein saga, the last installment of which had been The Ghost of Frankenstein.
Which is typically, it seems to me, a real overlooked Frankenstein film from a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I flat out forget about it at times, frankly. And I think a lot of people maybe do. In my experience or memory, I don't know that it was run very often on television, at least not that I managed to stumble upon it.
Yeah, I don't remember ever seeing it on television until VHS came around.
Right, I didn't see it until the painted box.
Oh, yeah.
VHS
has
release.
Has beautiful artwork on those boxes,
the
too.
Universal Monster Man. Series VHS releases from, I guess they started in the late 80s with those. I want to say I got my first one in 89.
It could have been. Yeah, it could have been. It could have been late 80s. I want to say it was early 90s, though.
Must have been very early 90s. Because I had Dracula by 90 at the latest.
Yeah.
It might have been 91. No one cares about this but
no.
You and me.
Frankenstein
we
meets
should,
Wolfman.
We should move on. But they were great boxes on those VHS.
Beautiful.
You just take our word for it.
They should have made posters of those or something.
Yeah. So, yes, Ghost Frankenstein, overlooked, undervalued, in my opinion, not undeservedly so. It is not, in my opinion, the weakest entry in the Universal Frankenstein series, but it may be the least engaging. I wouldn't call House of Frankenstein great, and I wouldn't call House of Dracula good.
No.
But they are fun in their way.
And they move along at a good clip.
They do. And there's a lot going on in them. Ghost is, I don't know, it's not engaging. I'll just fall back on
Chaney didn't make a bad monster, though.
No.
I mean, he had to follow Karloff. So he had a lot to live up to, and he didn't quite do it, but he wasn't bad. He's just not very memorable because, like you say, I think you hit the nail on the head with that. It wasn't very engaging, but it's important that it leads into Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
It is very important to know the events of that film to get a complete understanding of both what you see and maybe even more importantly, what you don't get to see.
Exactly.
In Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
Okay, now what we're referring to is later in the film, in Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, there's a scene where Larry Talbot breaks the monster out of the ice, and immediately after that, they're walking around through the ruins. Well, there was a scene in between there that got cut where they sit down in front of the fire that Talbot has built and they have a conversation. Yes, the monster was supposed to talk in this movie. And the reason that Ghost is important and we're referencing that now is because at the very end of Ghost, he does talk. Now, back in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, Bela Lugosi played the monster. So Lugosi's doing talking for the monster. When they previewed the film for the studio executives, they thought it was laughable, his accent coming out of the monster, which is kind of ridiculous being everything in that region they're supposed to be kind of in. And ridiculous, because in the previous movie, Igor, played by Lugosi, wanted whichever Frankenstein it was, one of the sibling Frankensteins, to put his brain in the monster's body so he would be strong and virile again. So at the very end of the movie, he's speaking, it's Chaney's monster, but he's speaking with Lugosi's voice. And he can't see. That's another very important thing that leads into Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. The operation, he got Igor's brain and he could speak, but he was blind, left blind. He couldn't see. So they never really explain that because they cut the scene where they were talking in Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. You'd never get to know that the monster is blind or really can't see very well, and he was supposed to talk. So that really makes Lugosi's performance look really awkward.
Yeah.
He's moving his mouth and nothing's coming out, and when he's staggering around with his arms out.
To a certain extent, it's not just the dialogue they excise, but it's sort of a whole subplot involving, you know, what the monster actually wanted and what its motivations were for this film. I mean, Igor, again, played by Lugosi in first in Son of Frankenstein, the third entry in Ghost, who befriended and ultimately controlled the monster over the course of those films, wanted the monster's power with his wits so that he could take over the world. Because, you know, what else are you going to do? That's right. His ambitions did not die when he is restored, or the reason why he wants to be restored to full power so that he can resume his original plan of taking over the world. If I remember correctly, you've read the script book more recently than I have. That is addressed to some extent in the dialogue, or at least
I do believe it is. I do believe it is, because they have this long conversation, and it would have really changed the direction of the movie and given you. It would have added a lot more weight to the film and a lot more to Lugosi's performance. It wouldn't look as awkward as it is, as it does look. And it's really odd when you see anybody imitating the Frankenstein monster these days. They do with the arms outstretched and walking real stiff, and they're doing Lugosi. They're not doing Karloff, who did 3 Frankenstein films. They're not doing Chaney. They're not doing Glenn Strange, who did 2. Well, Glenn Strange is kind of doing Lugosi, I guess. But everybody imitates Lugosi Frankenstein, where in the Karloff, it's real subtle movements, and the arms are kind of closer into the body. And Lugosi's, they're outstretched, and it's real broad.
And knowing that the monster was meant to be blind may or may not have made that performance more palatable. That's debatable, but it certainly would have given it some context so you can understand what he was trying to do. Without that context, you just wonder what on earth he's up to, you know, and what on earth he was thinking.
Who made that decision?
You know, who made that call, right? You just think he's not taking it seriously, really, is what it comes down to. If you are aware, which a lot of people are, it's mentioned, if you watch just about any documentary or featurette on the original Frankenstein from 1931, they will tell you that the part of the monster was originally offered to Bela Lugosi, and he turned it down because he thought it was, according to legend, he thought it was beneath him. He didn't like that.
He didn't have any dialogue.
Right. And he saw himself as a leading man. I mean, this is right on the heels of Dracula, which had been a big hit.
Largely
because of, if not entirely, because of Lugosi and Freund's cinematography and the places where that gets to shine. But that's a whole other discussion.
That's a big other discussion.
But the point is, if you go straight from one of those featurettes that mentions that, or, you know, one of the thousands of books or magazines that you may have read growing up in the era that we did that references that into Frankenstein versus the Wolfman, you can easily make the assumption that he really didn't take it seriously. He didn't really want to play it, and that's why it comes off as awkward and stiff and poor. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what I thought for that reason, because I had enough information to know he maybe didn't cherish that role, but not enough to know the rest of it, in that he was actually trying to do something specific with that importance by playing blind.
Well, and also, Bela was 60 years old when he did this movie, and that's a lot of makeup, a lot of weight and costume, and everything else to have to put on every morning and act in.
Well, the other piece of this also is that the real shame of it is that the only reason that I can imagine that anyone would have thought it was a good idea to cast Bela at 60 as the monster was so that he could do Igor's. I mean, it makes sense if you think about it, that the monster is now, physically, it's still what it was, you know, in theory, but in terms of its mind and behavior and motivation, it is Igor. That's what the monster is now. It's got his brain in its head.
Yeah.
Right? The monster, as it had been, whatever mind it had, no longer exists at this point. So it makes a certain sense to say, well, instead of, you know, dubbing over Chaney or someone else, because the plan, if I remember correctly, initially was to have Chaney play.
I was going to bring that up,
both to play Talbot / the Wolfman and to play the monster.
Yes.
and use trick photography to have both. But at some point, someone must have decided, well, let's, instead of doing that and all that the time and expense and hassle that goes into that, and then having to dub Lugosi's voice or just have a different voice if they cared about that kind of continuity, it's hard to say. But let's just have Lugosi come in and do his thing. So maybe that's what they were thinking. Maybe it was just the marquee value. Lugosi, by this point in the 40s, was no longer what you would call a bankable star. I mean, he was already doing monogram pictures.
He was doing like the Bowery Boy stuff, right, and Old Mother Riley Meets the Vampire.
But for horror films specifically, he was still considered to have marquee value, which is something that the studio Universal valued at this point. They still wanted to have horror stars that they could advertise.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they had Lon Chaney Jr. play pretty much all of their classic monster stable over the course of the 40s. Anyhow,
yeah.
What point is there to have Bela if you're not going to have him effectively play Igor in the monster's body? Because, and this is what all of my questioning this hinges on, he looks terrible in the role. Just awful.
He doesn't. The makeup doesn't fit his face very good at all. Unlike Glenn Strange, who it works.
Yeah, so with Glenn Strange, you finally get a post-Karloff monster who looks great. He's a very interesting look as the monster. You know, very, very arresting face in that makeup and everything. And he gets to do nothing.
Yeah, nothing at all. But that's another discussion, too.
That's a whole other discussion.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, Lugosi, you know, he does Dracula, looks great, does Igor, looks fantastic, and does the Frankenstein monster, and just the makeup just isn't right on his face. It's just he doesn't have the right face for it, and is poor Bela, as Karloff was supposed to have said at one time or another.
Yeah, so, you know, we're bouncing all over the place here,
but
as is our style, if you will, if there is said to be one. It is a bouncing style.
That's right.
It's a swinging style, baby.
It's swinging. I don't have my clinky ice glass, but that's okay.
But I did want to jump back a little bit and point out that Igor the Mad Shepherd, the role that, as we mentioned, Bela originates in Son of Frankenstein, and then plays through the next two movies, even though that aspect of it gets cut out of the third, the one that we're discussing now.
Yeah.
That's one of his, at least as far as what you get in Son of Frankenstein, in my opinion, it's one of his very best performances.
Oh, yeah.
It's outstanding. I mean, he lights that movie up. With Bride, we had a Karloff monster that gets to speak and emote, and, you know, that brought a lot to that movie. You know, he's reduced once again to being silent and brutish, and he's meant to be sort of deteriorating. He doesn't have his full power anymore, so he very much lumbers in this at this point in a way that the Karloff monster hadn't before. You get Basil Rathbone as the latest representative of the Frankenstein family, and he's always great, of course. But Bela absolutely steals the movie, all of the threat and all of the sinister and all of the creepy and all of the suspense really comes from him.
They said.
Yeah, I stole bodies. And that's one reason why Ghost doesn't, and there's several, but Ghost doesn't quite work for me, is because I feel like their performance isn't as good there. I think if you had never seen Son, you can enjoy it. But if you have, especially if you watch them back to back, it really does feel like there's a very controlled and focused performance that you get in Son, whereas that control and that focus is lost in Ghost. And he's bigger, and he's kind of all over the place, and it just doesn't have the same impact.
Well, Ghost was kind of a let's hurry up and get this movie made
kind of
thing. Let's turn it out. Boom, boom. So we could get to Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
Yeah.
How you like that?
Yeah.
That's a good segue.
It's good.
But let's go back. Now, when we talked before about it, though, we got to talk about the beginning of the film. Okay, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. The first thing you get when after the credits roll is the two grave robbers coming through that beautiful cemetery set, which is shot inside in the studio. But it's fantastic. It's moody. It's atmospheric. And these two bumbling grave robbers come in and break into the Talbot tomb. And then there's dialogue where he says the legend. He recites the poem.
Right.
And then we see the moonlight. And then we see the hand come up out of the crypt or tomb and grab one of them. And his buddy says, bye. And leaves in there. The guy just freezes. But that whole scene, I mean, boom, right off the bat, you're getting action.
Yeah, it is excellent. It is gorgeous and beautifully lit and atmospheric, and really, I would say there's certainly no guilt in my appreciation of this film for me. I think its best moments are probably the best moments visually of the 40s for the Universal Monsters series specifically. The monster films, the horror films for Universal were very much relegated to low budget B status, mm-hmm. with some exceptions. I mean, they spent some money on the Frankenstein movies more than they did on the others, typically. Yeah. Universal's bid to, you know, become a major, which it still wasn't at this point, hadn't really completely come to fruition in the 30s. The Lemleys sold it, and the new management really wasn't interested in sinking a lot of money into anything that wasn't a Deanna Durbin picture. And that's another discussion. Anyhow, the monster movies, they were literally cranking out 60-minute programmers, mm-hmm. again, with exceptions.
Yeah, yeah.
They did introduce one major new character in this era, being Larry Talbot, Wolfman, played by Lon Chaney Jr. in the previous film to this one. The other previous film to this one, of course, because as we said, it's a sequel to two different movies. However, I'll stop rambling and get to the point, which is that this one was something of a, you know, relative to what else they were doing, especially in this genre. This movie was something of a major production for Universal.
Yeah.
They did spend a good amount of money on it. They did spend a good amount of time and money promoting it. I mean, it was very, very successful for them, and it probably kept the monsters alive for another couple of years.
Well, the push on this, the advertising push was fantastic.
Yeah.
If you check out the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page, I'll put some pictures up later on after this airs, or just before it airs, whenever that may be, of some of the advertising gimmicks and displays and things that were actually at the movie theaters, which were just mind-blowing to see compared to what they do now, which you might get a cardboard standee and a poster in the theater somewhere in the big multiplex. These were mom and pop theaters where they showed one, they had one screen, one feature, and they had to draw you in. So they had displays taking up the whole front of the theater and on top of the ticket booth, and big, larger than life size posters of the figures and die cut cardboard cutouts and things to grab your attention from down the block and make you want to come see what's over there and see the feature. And it's just beautiful stuff, just amazing stuff. So they did. They put a lot of money into not just the feature itself, but into getting it out there and in the public eye. And if I'm not mistaken, I think this was probably one of the last ones that was set in, like, the gothic fairy tale Universal land. Maybe Daughter of Dracula was, but I'm not sure where that plays
in.
Was that earlier?
30s. That's 30s. 30s.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's still, so this is probably one of the last ones that was set in this, the fictional Universal European.
The one that you'd recognize. I mean, I think the house pictures take place in some kind of European Neverland, but it's not really recognizable as the one that we've been seeing since.
Yeah, with the fog covered woods and everything. After this, they bring them more into a modern setting. I believe, like, the Mummy films, mm-hmm. and what was Son of Dracula? What year was that? I forgot.
Oh, boy. Don't remember either.
Well, anyway, he comes to America in the bayou.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're out of...
And also, I believe the third Mummy film, Mummy's Ghost, takes place in New Orleans or somewhere in Louisiana, is meant to, anyway. And that actually was a pretty neat idea, I thought. That sort of atmosphere and look, I mean, that's a great way to have it in the U.S.
And still get a semblance of that kind of fairy tale universe. Yeah.
It has its moments, brief though they are, in Mummy's Ghost, but I got that right. That's the third one, right? Mummy's Ghost? Yeah. And then I like those movies.
I yield to your knowledge. I need to go back and give them a chance. I haven't watched any of the Mummy films in a long time.
I
need to go back and check those out.
This is a huge digression, but what the hell is the point in doing this if we can't digress?
I do what I want.
I'm not recommending them. Not to you or anyone. I'm not sitting here saying that they're good. I'm just saying that, you know, there's a particular little damaged piece of my frontal lobe that processes these movies as enjoyable. No, that's overstating it. They have their moments. I mean, the Mummy's the Mummy's hand is what it is. It has its moments. It doesn't know whether it wants to be scary or funny, and it ends up being neither. And of course, you know, that's not Chaney Jr. as the Mummy anyway. But then as you get into the next one,
Captain Marvel.
What was it? Hand, Tomb, Ghost, and Curse. Anyway, we're experts on this subject, folks. Trust us.
And then Goes West was, I think, the last one, wasn't it?
Yeah. The Mummy Goes West. Actually, there was an Abbott and Costello.
There was Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy.
Anyhow, the first one's not good. The second one's terrible, but it's really those last two, Ghost and Curse, that I just enjoy the heck out of for reasons that aren't quite lickable. Although I will point to, there's at least one scene in the final one that's as good, just as a moment, is as good as anything.
Oh,
it's where
okay.
The Princess Ananka awakens and rises up out of the mud and into the sunlight, and you don't remember what the hell I'm talking about.
No, I'm going to have to check that out.
Since
though.
It's not, we'll just move on.
Move in right along. Okay,
I'm going to edit all this out. By the way.
No, leave it. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. It's informative, and we may come back later to some of this. But Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman is where we were. And how the mummy relates to that, well, you know, we just told you. It doesn't.
I don't remember, anyway. But I'm sure we just told you.
No, but what we're talking about is bringing it into modern-day settings, and this is one of the last ones that had that really gothic feel to
it.
That's
what it was, yeah.
With the castles and the big laboratory and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I'll keep going back and just repeating myself and saying, for me, it's a great film, because it was the first one I saw, and it was the first time I saw Dr. Madblood, and the Wolfman's in it, so... You know, I'm a sucker for it anyway. And the makeup looks better, I think. The Wolfman makeup looks better than in the first film in this. And he did progressively change slightly from film to film. Not so much in the last two. In the house, they was pretty much the same. But the first one to this one is quite a difference. Same guy, Jack Pierce, doing it, but changed his mind. Made some little tweaks along the way.
And the transformation sequences get a little more ambitious in this one.
Well, this is the first one, the first time we get a full dead-on face transformation into the Wolfman. Because I believe in the first film, in the Wolfman, we see his feet change. We see him change back to Talbot, I think, at the end. But we never see his face change from Talbot to the Wolfman until he's in the hospital right at the beginning of this movie. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful change.
Yeah.
Especially with the way it had to be done back then.
The way that whole scene is done is really, really great. You know, you've got him asleep in the hospital bed at night, and then the moon comes out, and you get this moonbeam through the window on the floor.
Yeah.
As the moonlight spreads across the room,
it's coming to get
the
him.
Camera pans to follow it as we go over to the bed. It's like the moonlight is stalking Talbot, you know, to bring out the Wolfman. That's just one of those really great atmospheric moments that really make this one, I think, one of the best features they did of this type in that era. Just thoughtful things like that.
Well, and stuff you don't really think about when you're just watching it.
Yeah.
But it makes a lot of sense once you sit down and really watch it and analyze it. It's like, man, that was just, you know, whoever thought of that? That's just an amazing little bit.
Yeah.
And of course, then he goes out and there's that iconic shot of him jumping up on the boxes, crouching all fours, and then leaping and attacking the policeman, which is a great little scene. And then,
fortunately, they cut out the part where the Wolfman changes out of his jammies.
You beat me to it.
And into his work clothes.
That, yeah, you know, and as a kid, you don't really pay attention to that. But when you watch it now, it's like, okay, he's in the bed in white pajamas, and he's out on the streets of Wolfman. He's got his Dickies work shirt and pants on. And when he comes back, you find him back laying across the bed, back in his pajamas. And the Wolfman work clothes are nowhere to be seen. But you know what? We don't care when we're watching it.
No.
Because it's done so well.
I don't care all that much now. It's just yeah. We're doing a podcast, and it's fun to point it out on the podcast. Yeah. But
well, you know, he thought he was going to catch a cold and need something warmer in pajamas. Yeah, you know?
Wolfman is very practical.
I mean, he's no Henry Hull.
No.
When it comes to best dressed Wolfman, but, you know, or Oliver Reed for that matter.
Well,
yeah, it was sharp.
Somebody's going to have to find themselves and choose to sport a really Mac Daddy chapeau before they can even begin to compete with the Henry Hull.
That's true. That's true. But as the movie goes on, we get reintroduced to Maliva, the gypsy, Maria Ospenskaya, who was great in the first Wolfman.
In the first Wolfman, she had the task of delivering all the lore, right, of explaining that even a man who is pure at heart and says his prayers by night
may become a wolf when the Wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright.
Right.
Which they changed it to. Do you like that sound?
No.
That's the straw going up down in my cup. Either that or I'm tuning my violin. They changed that line, though. I believe it was Autumn Moon is Full and Bright in the first movie, The Wolfman. And later on in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, I believe they changed it to When the Moon is Full and Bright. So he didn't just change in the fall.
No, can't have that. Bad idea. So we're referencing the Wolfman, you know, but we've actually spent more time talking about Ghost of Frankenstein and almost none talking about the Wolfman. And I don't know that we need to talk about the Wolfman all that much.
No.
Except,
get it, see it.
That's right. Except that's to say, of course, that it's a classic and it's great and you should see it. But the reason why I wanted to sort of zero in on it in a minute is to point out that as we go along, so we've talked about the opening at the crypt and then the hospital, and he meets some characters, at least one of which will reappear throughout the movie in the hospital, and then he goes back and finds Maliva the gypsy, mm-hmm. and we're maybe, how long are we into it at this point? 20 mm-hmm. minutes, maybe 15, mm-hmm. something like that. It's quite some time before we see the monster or even get much of a reference.
Or even Lugosi, for
right,
that matter.
Right, right. At this point, and for some time after the point where we left off with the reintroduction of Maliva, this could easily just simply have been a sequel to The Wolfman.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked about this before, something we brought up about it. It's two separate movies almost.
Yeah.
It becomes a different movie. What, after he leaves the hospital? Is that where he decided?
No, it's when was it? It's when the monster's introduced.
When the monster appears, it becomes a different movie. Okay. Yeah. But you're right. It could be. It's a straight Wolfman sequel up until the point where the monster's even mentioned.
The tie-in that we get, of course, is that when he finds Maliva at the end of Wolfman, we believe that he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the only way to take him out is with silver. The reason why he got bit is he took out another werewolf played by Bela Lugosi, as a matter of fact,
yes.
with his silver cane, bashes in its skull with his silver cane, but gets bit in the process.
He got bit in his process.
Exactly. So there's there's nothing to lead us to believe that the whole silver gimmick's not going to work out. Mm. But sure enough, as soon as someone opens up his coffin and takes out the wolfbane and lets some moonshine on him, he...
gave him some moonshine, did he?
Because moonshine always gets me going. I don't know about you.
He wasn't dead. He was stunned.
He's running about. So anyhow...
he was just stunned.
He finds Maliva, and his goal at this point, his motivation, is he wants to find a way to die and have peace. And it's, if I remember correctly, it's either stated or implied.
I just shook my head at the microphone, like you could hear that. Like, I acknowledged what Tony was saying. I was like,
good.
Shook my head
me.
Like, yeah. And this is like radio, not like television.
This is an as it happens conversation, folks.
That's right.
And sometimes we won't. It won't happen that we will actually bother to say anything to the microphone.
I caught myself doing that. That's okay. Anyway, so.
So there's something implied in the dialogue between them. Maybe it's just flat out stated. I don't quite recall that he has to be allowed to die. They don't address it directly, but there's an implication that the reason why Bela was allowed to die and Larry wasn't is because it was Bela's time.
Mm-hmm.
But now until... fate or God or the curse or whatever it's meant to be allows Talbot to die, he just has to go on. But there's got to be another way.
Yes.
And she says that she's heard tell of this famous wacko who's done some experiments with life and death, and maybe he'll know the secret of being able to find something science-y to take out the Wolfman with, as opposed to waiting for God or whatever the other option was meant to be.
Yes.
So that's where we bring in the Frankenstein idea at that point to say, we're going to go into Universal Neverland Europe, or Viseria, I believe it is referred to in the several pictures.
So. Yeah.
And find this Dr. Frankenstein and get fixed up.
Apparently the original Dr. Frankenstein and not the one from Ghost, not the sibling.
So that concept is introduced here, but we still won't see the monster for quite some time.
Or Lugosi.
After this point. Yeah, or at least, you know, it's not the longest film ever. I say quite some time, but...
It moves along at a really good clip.
It does, and relative to its length and pace, it is some time before we'll see the monster at this point.
Yeah, now what I keep getting at, making reference to, before we even see Lugosi, is the first time we see the monster, his face is behind ice, and he's just standing there, eyes closed, leaning back, and it's not even Lugosi. It's the stuntman, Eddie Parker, in the Frankenstein makeup that did all of Lugosi's stunts in the film.
The first shot where you actually clearly see the monster's face is like a medium close-up. It's like a head and shoulders. It's, you know, the camera's not right up on the face.
Yeah.
So the first time you see that, and you can tell without a doubt that it's not Bela Lugosi, you think to yourself, okay, well, when we get into the close-up, we're going to see some Bela, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then from there, we do cut to the close-up right up on the face, and it's still not...
No, not until he's out of the ice and walking around.
Shambling about with his arms out.
Yeah. Is it Bela? And poor Bela.
Yeah. And again, he doesn't look good in the role. We complain about not getting to see him.
Which maybe isn't a bad thing.
But then when you do, you know, he doesn't have the face for it. And I don't know, even in his young, slim, sharp days, think Dracula the first time around in 31, that he had the face for it. I mean,
he has more of a squared off kind of shape to his head. And Karloff set the standard with that long, thin face. Right. And even Glenn Strange has kind of a longer face, even though it's not like Karloff's, but the shape of it, you know, is like more drawn out.
But both Chaney in Ghost and Lugosi here have rounder, puffier faces, which just does not work for the monster. It's just the first thing that jumps right out at you.
Now, I do want to state for the record, as much as we are tearing on Bela in this film, we're not tearing on Bela. We love Bela, and both of us, and each have our favorite Bela films and agree that he was amazing in them.
Yeah.
But in this particular one, this was just not the right role for him, not the right time, and what the things that would have made it palatable were cut out. We're left on the cutting room floor, which is a shame.
Well, it would have justified it to some extent. We didn't get to see those scenes. We'll never get to see those scenes. As far as anyone knows, they don't exist anymore. So for all we know, the performance wasn't there this time. And you know, that happens. And I'm a huge Bela fan. I love him, and some of his performances are among my very favorite performances by anyone ever, period. But he did need to be used right. I get the sense that he did need to be directed, maybe reined in sometimes.
Yeah.
That's speculation on my part, just through what I've observed, performances from one film to another. But particularly when you get to this era, where you got to figure from his perspective, he never knew whether he was working on Poverty Row or for a studio from one picture to the next, you know?
Yeah, he was making rent.
And there are performances of his in this era, particularly and especially, that are just not as strong as others.
Pull the string!
And there's
Pull
some,
the string!
There's some in movies where you don't, you wouldn't imagine that particular picture deserves as good as he gives it, and he still gives it pretty good, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And there's others where he's got a small part that he just comes on and mugs and, you know, does exaggerated reaction shots. Anyway, another digression. The point is that we may never know, we will never know, perhaps that the delivery wasn't good, the performance wasn't there, whatever it was. Perhaps the folks at the studio were right to reject it. I don't like to believe that's true. But the point is, having him perform the role with the dialogue as Igor in the monster's body would have at least justified his casting, and hopefully would have taken it from regrettable physical performance into an enjoyable all-around performance.
Yeah. And if you're interested in that scene that was excised from the film, if you can locate a copy of the Universal Film Script Series for Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, it does have the complete script with that scene and all the dialogue in it, so it'll give you more of a perspective of the way the film would have gone. But the way it did go, it's still enjoyable and fun to watch, and for a lot of the reasons we've been saying, and a few more we're going to talk about too. Okay, so we've gotten to the point where he's dug the monster out of the ice. He escaped from the hospital, dug the monster out of the ice. Dr. Mannering, was it Cliff Mannering? Was that his name in this?
That sounds great, by the way.
Cliff Mannering. Anyway.
It's Mannering.
Dr. Mannering.
It's Patrick Knowles.
Patrick Knowles is in hot pursuit
let's just say this. We're in the role of David Manners, Patrick Knowles. It's a little inside joke for the Universal fans out there. Just very much the bland Universal handsome leading man type.
And Talbot has... when he dug the monster out, he was trying to find the Frankenstein's journals. Couldn't find them. So he locates the next best thing. A Frankenstein heir. Because apparently Frankenstein was throwing seed all over Europe because he's got kids coming out of the woodwork.
Every sequel we're introduced to another member of the Frankenstein family. We've had two brothers and
now we get
a granddaughter, because she's actually supposed to be the daughter of one of the brothers.
Yeah, of the previous one.
I don't remember if it's Wolf or Cedric Hardwick.
Cedric Hardwick, that's right.
Basil Rathbone is Wolf,
yeah,
son of Frankenstein, and Cedric. Hardwick was the other son of Frankenstein, whose name escapes me right now. But anyhow.
That's what they should have called that movie, not Ghost of Frankenstein. They should call it The Other Son of Frankenstein.
Is she supposed to, because isn't Evelyn Anchors Cedric Hardwick's daughter in Ghost? So is she meant to be the Evelyn Anchors character, or have we just forgotten about the Evelyn Anchors character at this point?
We've just forgotten about her, because I did.
As I've stated several times at this point, Ghost is not a favorite of mine, so I don't watch it that often, and my memory on it is far shakier than pretty much any of the other movies in this series. So
you know,
I could be totally wrong, but I know Evelyn Anchors is definitely in it, because...
yes, she is.
She's definitely in it, because... And I'm probably going to cut this out of the final podcast, but you remember that one time I told you, cue up Ghost of Frankenstein at exactly however many minutes and however many seconds and look real close and you can see Evelyn Anchor's nipples through her nightgown. Anyhow.
No, leave this in because now people are going to be writing in to the email, which we'll state at the end of the podcast, or the Facebook page and asking, how many minutes is that into the film?
Yeah.
Hey, wait till we talk about the Raven, not the Raven, the Black Cat at some point. We got a real treat at the end of that film for you.
That's you can find pornography on the internet any second of any day, and you can find endless piles of modern films with lots and lots of gratuitous nudity, and none of that is even as remotely as exciting to me as seeing a hint of something you know you're not supposed to see.
Oh yeah,
an old black and white movie.
It's
from
naughty,
the 40s.
It's forbidden.
I mean, it's different in the 30s or in the pre-code era where you got a pretty good chance of seeing something in those days. But when everything was on total lockdown in the 40s. And you know, something snuck by. But the sheer gown and the lighting was exactly right and nobody managed to catch it. And oh, look at that. It's
a beautiful thing.
I'm a sad, pathetic man. That's true.
No, you're observant.
Let's move on.
Yes. Where were we? So, Talbot has found the Frankenstein heir, which is Ilona Massey. Ilona Massey, who's a beautiful woman. And he meets her in...
Star of The Invisible Agent.
Okay. And...
No, she really is.
I believe you. I'm not denying it. I'm just, okay, right on. But this leads to one of the favorite scenes of everybody and one of the more memorable scenes in the film is the Festival of the New Wine, where they go down to have some dinner and the Farola Faroli guys walk around singing.
No, don't hold back and have
a
pass.
No. I'm
Let's
not
have
do it.
It.
No, I can't
Let's
do
have
it.
It.
I can't do it. I'm not a baritone.
All right, I'll do it.
Okay.
Farola Faroli.
Okay, now do the lyric. Do the rest of it. Do a verse.
Come one and all and sing it. My song. Farola, faroli.
That's all you get. Anyway, watch the film if you want the rest of it. But yeah, that guy was just loving that part too, man. He was going for it. But it's great because he sings the line, death is short and
life is short.
Life is short and
death is long.
Oh, and no, but he sings a line, may they live eternally. He's talking about Ilona Massey, Baroness Frankenstein.
Yeah,
and
I think he gets a cockeyed look for the life is short but death is long thing. But
yeah, Cheney goes up.
It's the live eternally line that pisses him right off.
Yeah, and then Talbot just loses it and goes off on him and the crowd and they shrink away in fear because one thing, he's bigger than all of them. Cheney is a big man. And then that's where...
Why would you say that to me?
Oh, won't you help me? And you believe him, too. He's, oh, man, he plays the pathetic...
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
We've done so much complaining about the way Bela was handled. I won't say the casting of Bela, but the way Bela was handled in this film that we've sort of not bothered to point out that Lon Chaney was so great as Larry Talbot. I mean...
Oh, it was... He owned the role.
It's his signature role, and he's great in it every time from the first time to the last.
He is the ultimate everyman.
He's the reason to watch, in my opinion, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Because his performance as Talbot in that is no less great than any of the others. You know, it's just,
it's
compelling all the way through. I could watch him do it 1,000 times. Yeah. And I have watched him do it 1,000 times. But and he loved it. He appreciated it. It was important to him.
He called the Wolfman his baby.
Right. Whereas, you know, he didn't necessarily want to get stuck with some of the other monster roles that Universal had him in while he was under contract there. I mean, he didn't think he was right for Dracula any more than anyone else does, although I will defend that performance as saying that he tried really hard and I think gave the best performance that he could in that.
It's an interesting performance and not a bad overall movie.
But that's a whole other discussion.
That's right.
Anyhow, he's good is what I want to say.
Oh, yeah. He is a treat to watch play Larry Talbot. Because like you say, he's consistent through every film he does it without being boring. You look forward to it to see, you know, the pain that he's going through and him expressing it. And you buy it. It's not like he's chewing scenery or he's right on the verge of chewing scenery, but it's held back a little bit.
I seem to remember some quote from Kurt Sodmak, however you pronounce that.
Yeah, sounds good. Sodmak.
The guy that wrote this film in The Wolfman. Chaney always wanted you to give him a scene where he could cry or show anguish. I can't remember exactly what the quote was. But remember, he had played Lenny in Of Mice and Men.
Oh, yeah.
To great acclaim.
Yeah.
So
that put him on the map, basically.
Right, right. So the tragedy of Talbot, I'm sure, is something that Chaney appreciated and took seriously and put a lot into, which is what makes those performances work.
I agree. Right. I don't have anything to add to that statement because, I mean, you know, it's we've said it.
So the Festival of the New Wine and
Dr. Mannering.
Dr. Mannering.
Has found him.
Right. So Chaney escapes. We sort of failed to mention. We sort of failed to introduce Dr. Mannering. He shows up in the hospital. Well, he is Chaney's doctor while Chaney is in the hospital. And when Chaney escapes from the hospital, Mannering follows, thinking that basically he's like a homicidal maniac, right? He doesn't believe that he's a werewolf. Not yet. Although they do go and investigate.
Yeah, they go back to Llanwely
in Wales, yeah,
and investigate the Talbot Crypt that has been, the body has been robbed and taken.
They being Mannering and the inspector who was on the case.
Yeah, and the
of the Wolfman murders.
And the Llanwely police chief, or whatever they call him in that town, says, yeah, he remembers Larry Talbot. He died 5 years ago.
Yeah,
and
right.
So they're like, oh, this man can't be Larry Talbot.
So Mannering, I guess, has some suspicions at this point, but he's still not convinced. So he shows up and tries to sort Chaney out and meets Ilona Massey, of course, because you got to have a pairing at some point.
And says, well, maybe I will listen to what Larry Talbot has to say.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that a whole lot of what happens in this part of the story or with the Mannering character, aside from what I want to get to here, is all that interesting, which is why I'll skip ahead to what I want to get to here, which is the Frankenstein journals, or what do they call them? The diaries, the journals, the notebooks, yeah, whatever they refer to them as. Let's call them the journals.
We'll say journals. That sounds
the history of his experiments with life and death and the creation of the monster. It's a theme that pops up several times in the series. And the amazing thing about these journals is they have a magical ability.
Yeah.
A magical ability to transform anyone who reads them, especially if they're a doctor or any kind of science guy at all, into a mad scientist.
That's right.
Right. No matter what you think about experimenting with life and death or trying to play God or creating monsters or robbing graves, no matter what your moral fiber may be, if you read that damn journal,
book open.
You've got to test Frankenstein's theories. You've got to know.
Good. Work!
That's exactly right. So, as we mentioned before, Talbot couldn't find the journals, but of course, when Ilona Massey shows up as one of the Frankenstein family members,
she knew right where
the granddaughter, she can lead them to it. Mannering gets his hands on it. He falls under its spell and gets instantly turned into a mad scientist. And this is what sort of sends us hurtling headlong towards our... Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea in this, if I'm not mistaken, is once he reads the journals, he sees how the monster was created. He figures he can siphon the life out of Talbot.
Right. So, right. The thing that he says he must do in this case, Mannering, that is, says he must do, is see the monster at its full strength.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's met the monster. He's seen it. He knows that it's real. He's read the journals, but he doesn't see it the way that Frankenstein got to see it when it was first created and at its full strength, and he must see it at its full strength. So, since Talbot wants to die and Mannering wants the monster at full strength, the idea is to siphon off the...
life energy.
Right, of Talbot and feed it to the monster. If we had Igor's dialogue at this point, I'm sure that would suit old Igor just fine.
Well, you do see in that scene of I Do Believe, where they have their both hooked up to the electrodes and the juice is coming to the monster. Lugosi sort of cracks a little smile, a little grin as he's starting to get the electricity's going to him.
Sinister look in his eyes.
Yeah. So he realizes what's happening.
And it's a pretty effectively sinister look on his eyes. I mean,
that's probably his best moment.
Yeah, it is his best
in the
moment.
Film. It's that little bit right there.
It's one that sort of sticks in your brain, which is good because I think it might be, if it's not the last shot of the monster that's actually Lugosi, it's among the last shots. Because in the final battle, of course, there's one other.
You get
Yes. And that's right. Okay, second to last shot that you get.
And it is a close up. So,
right.
But yeah, and from this scene, this is the end of the in the film, and we get the big battle we've been waiting for.
Right. So the villagers interrupt, or a rogue villager, I should say, interrupt the experiment by blowing up a dam, and the castle is going to flood, and the regular folk have to escape to survive. But of course, the monsters are too busy throwing down at this point because the interruption has helped them break loose from the experiment tables where they were strapped down.
You know, and it's not by today's standards, it's not a great action scene at all. I mean, there's no wire work. There's no.
I think it's still solid,
but that's what I was getting to though. I think it holds up from watching the movie from the beginning. It's a great little battle. I mean, the Wolfman is leaping off of the equipment onto the Frankenstein monster, and the two stuntmen are just rolling around and grappling and leaping and throwing each other, and it's you're into it.
Yeah.
And it works.
Yeah.
And then of course the flood washes them all away. Until the next sequel. Which the next sequel that we see either of them in,
House of Frankenstein,
which I don't remember. How is that the one with Onslow?
No, it's Karloff.
Karloff. Okay. Lampini. Professor Lampini's.
Yeah. Although that's not his.
He kills Lampini and takes over his traveling circus. I tell you, a book you need to read if you haven't read it yet, and I can't remember if you have. I have it somewhere. It's called Return of the Wolfman.
I have read
Jeff Rovin. Incredible book, because it ties all the Universal, all the Wolfman movies together, and then what happens after that. And it's fantastic.
Last time I looked, it was out of print, by the way.
Amazing book, though.
No, it is really good.
Yeah.
It picks up...
Actually, yeah, it picks up right at the end of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Right. The Wolfman chasing Dracula scene is where, from Abbott and Costello is about where it picks up.
But it makes it all make sense and then continues on.
Right.
And fantastic, because there was nothing after that for the Wolfman on screen until the recent remake, which I just heard the other day. Actually, Phyllis pointed this out to me, that they are going to remake the Universal Monster series. And I'm like, you mean like what they just did? No, they were going to do another, apparently, I haven't checked this out myself, but another Wolfman, Frankenstein, Dracula, etc. But we don't care, because we're talking about Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, the original, right now.
Yeah, well.
Now, the reason, we go back and we talk about things, why this movie is so important. One, it was the first movie that I know of that was a sequel to two different movies. It's the first monster rally where two headlining characters were put together in the same movie in a battle.
Well, I mean, so the reason why it being a sequel to two different movies is important or even relevant is because it sort of ties the Universal monsters into a singular... They're all a part of the same universe. Into the same universe. Yeah. It introduces this idea that they all inhabit the same space. I mean, we had certainly seen actors pop up over and over again in the series and locations and sets and place names, but this is actually in story acknowledging the idea that these
characters all exist together.
Right. Two separate series are in fact one. And from there, of course, we launch into multiple team ups until the end.
Now we can argue or debate about what the decision to do this was. It the decision to put them in the same universe to establish that they were all part of the same universe, or was it just for the money?
Just for the money. No one was thinking nobody was thinking in those terms.
Well, see, I want to think in those terms because it's more fun, but I know better. It's for the money.
Well, Sodmak said, if I remember this correctly, that he proposed it as a joke.
Yeah, that's the story. He said it as a joke, like over lunch in the commissary at Universal one day, and whoever the studio head was, or not the head, but whoever heard him say it high up, either at the end of the lunch or later that day, came back to him or called him and said, write it.
Yeah.
I want a script by Monday.
Right.
And he did, because he wanted a new car.
Yeah.
And they paid him what a new car would cost at that time.
So I think it was just the recognition of the marquee value of taking two established and successful brands, basically, putting them together.
And the odd thing, I mean, after that, of course, we got the two House movies, which put them all together, but was really, each one of those is like two separate movies, because you have the Dracula part in one, and then he dies at the right after that, and then you got the Wolfman story with a little bit of Frankenstein story, and then House of Dracula. Well, Dracula goes through that one, pretty much, but the first one, and we'll have to do a podcast on both those films at some point. Another thing that's real interesting is this is the first time we've got the big two fighting, big rally movie, team up versus whatever. We didn't see that again, ever, until... If I'm not mistaken, maybe I'm forgetting some stuff here, because it's not unheard of, like Alien versus Predator or Freddy versus Jason.
Well, King Kong versus Godzilla.
Nah, the giant monster is totally different. That's a totally different discussion. But everybody loves Godzilla. Think about it, though. There was nothing else since after that until, I don't know if Freddy versus Jason came out first or Alien versus Predator, but all the missed opportunities along the way to cash in or to make something fun and interesting.
Yeah, from off the top of my head, I can't think of anything. Actually, you know what? You're going to laugh. Puppet Master versus Demonic Toys. right? Thank you,
Charles Band.
Full Moon did the hell out of some
versus and team up
type movies.
Yes, they did. And while we were talking here, it just popped into my head. We almost got one, though. How to Make a Monster.
Mm.
We got kind of Teenage Werewolf and Teenage Frankenstein, though they never really did it, battled or anything. They were both in the same movie, sort of. And to understand why I say sort of, go watch the movie, How to Make a Monster. Or that will be another discussion.
Well, you know what? This is embarrassing.
Yes, sir.
What about...
Oh, God. What did we miss?
Dracula versus Frankenstein.
Hey, that'll be another topic of another podcast, I'm sure, very, very soon. Unless we air that one first.
Yeah. That's okay. It's okay that we forgot about it because we've never discussed it before.
No, we've never discussed it or recorded it before. Anything
like that. Not conscious
of
it. Never heard of it before.
No. But man, what a film. That's all I'm going to say about that. So,
the Titans of Terror.
Oh, God. Al Adamson. We hardly knew ye. You got anything else? I think I'm about out.
I'm spent.
All right. Hey, if you have any comments or you want us to talk about anything else or you want to tell us something we forgot to say about this.
Oh, God. Don't ask Universal fans to tell us about all the things we left out or got wrong. Jesus.
Or if
Christ.
You just want to give us a thumbs up and say, hey, good job.
I like that plan.
You could drop us a line on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page or at our email at
phantasmopod.gmail or dot. I don't know how to use email, everybody. phantasmopod@gmail.com.
That's phantasmopod, not phantasmopud. Make sure you get that right. That's a totally different email for a different site entirely.
That's a different space on the internet altogether.
All right. Well, that was Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. Like I said, I will put up some pictures on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page for the advertising and things like that for Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. And that's all we've got for now. Until next time, when our topic will be... You got to tune in to find out. All right.
So, we don't know.
No, we don't know. All right. Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.